This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime, from BBC Radio 4, with me, Lucy Worsley. I'm joined by a crack team of all-female detectives to investigate the ordinary lives and extraordinary crimes of Victorian murderesses. Please be aware that this episode contains material and language which you might find distressing. This is the story of a woman who was very good at being very bad.
On Wednesday last at Broad Street Station, a tall, dark-skinned coloured woman boarded the 627 out of Philadelphia, on which train I was the conductor. She carried two bundles, one large and one small, wrapped in brown paper and calico. The woman left a lasting impression on me, because as soon as she reached her seat, she opened the window. Curious behaviour, I thought, in the middle of winter. When the train arrived in Eddington an hour later, I offered to assist the woman with her bundles, but she strenuously objected, hurriedly responding, "Oh no, I can carry them."
I'm Lucy Worsley, and this is Lady Killers, where true crime meets history with a twist. I'm taking a look, a feminist look actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses in Victorian Britain, North America, and beyond. We hear their words, their voices, and we ask, what do these lady killers tell us about the world in which they lived, and what do their stories tell us about our own lives now? Today's lady killer is a working-class black woman in 1880s America who lived life on her own terms, who was involved in a gruesome crime, and who dared to play the criminal justice system. It's 7:30 on the morning of Thursday the 17th of February 1887, and a carpenter called Silas Hibbs is walking to work in rural Eddington, a village a few miles outside Philadelphia, when he notices something strange in a pond.
I crossed over the bridge to get a better look. The package was wrapped in heavy brown paper marked "Handled with Care." I scrambled down the bank and opened it. It was horrifying. It was the trunk of a man without a head or limbs. Blood was flowing from the openings and the flesh was soft. He can't have been dead long.
Within days, the torso is identified as belonging to Wakefield Gaines, a young labourer. He was just 21. And forensic examination raises the truly awful possibility he'd still been alive when he was dismembered. His sister Jane has reported him missing, and she gets the gruesome task of identifying what little remains of her brother. She recognizes him by his unusual high, sloping shoulders. Jane tells the police that Wakefield was intimate with a local woman called Hannah Mary Tabbs. Jane says she suspects this woman of killing him. The police arrest Tabbs. She has a black eye that she claims she got falling onto a doorknob, that old story. And she's soon identified as the woman with the suspicious bundles on the train. To help me understand Hannah Mary Tabbs's extraordinary story and to explore the issues it still raises today, I'm joined by Dr. Callie Gross, National Endowment for the Humanities, Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, and author of a book, Hannah Mary Tabbs and the Disembodied Torso. Callie, welcome to Lady Killers. Now, we've got a picture here of Hannah Mary Tabbs. It's a sort of mugshot taken from when she was arrested. Can you describe her for us?
One of the things that struck me when I first saw the mugshot was how sort of regal and resolute she looked. Her hair is coiffed. She's got a fairly ornate blouse on with ribbons around the collar. She definitely was sort of the picture and model of respectability.
Hannah Mary Tabbs was born in 1855 in Maryland. Many African Americans were enslaved in that state at that time. Do you know, Callie, if she was born into slavery or not?
I think it's very likely that she was born into slavery. Certainly there's a distinction between people being enslaved or free, but in many respects, it's still freedom by degrees. All Black folks at this time are incredibly vulnerable to racist violence and the tyranny of white supremacy.
Now, after the Civil War, Tabbs and her much older husband, John, moved north to Philadelphia in 1876. He found a respectable job as a hotel porter. I asked Annie Anderson, who's a social historian specializing in criminal justice in Philadelphia, to go to the old center of the city and find out what it was like when Hannah Mary Tabbs was living there in the 1880s.
I'm strolling down Addison Street, formerly known as Richard Street, in Center City, Philadelphia. The street is a narrow, one-way thoroughfare with tightly packed red brick row houses on both sides. Today, the houses are well-maintained, with tidy black shutters, flower-filled window boxes, and other markers of middle-class respectability. But when Hannah Mary Tabbs lived here in the late 1800s, Richard Street probably looked more run down. These row houses likely hosting a higher density, more transient population. I'm looking at a map from that time, and I can see that Richard Street was one of many tiny side streets and back alleys that threaded through Philadelphia's bustling 7th Ward, the city's oldest Black neighborhood. When the noted sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois surveyed Philadelphia's 7th Ward in the 1890s, he created a set of color-coded maps to capture the class diversity of the city's Black population. On the 1700 block of Richard Street, where Tabbs lived, Du Bois's colors show a mix of mostly poor and working-class residents, with a handful of the so-called vicious and criminal classes mixed in. Hemmed in by racial segregation, Tabbs's 7th Ward neighborhood contained the highest concentration of the city's approximately 40,000 Black residents. Black women, facing racism and sexism, had limited job options, and many worked as domestic laborers for white people.
So, Callie Gross, what were the expectations, do you think, of Black working-class women living in places like Philadelphia's 7th Ward? How would a woman like Hannah Mary Tabbs be expected to behave?
On one hand, overall, the Black community placed a high premium on respectability, morality, chastity, traditional Christian values. At the same time, one of the things that I sort of quickly learned about Tabbs is that she certainly knew how to comport in the white world. She deferred to white authority. She carried herself in a respectable manner. She was a married woman. She was taking care of her supposedly orphaned niece. But in the Black community, she also learned how to traffic in a certain level of violence and intimidation as a way to kind of make space for herself in the community. The allegations against Hannah Mary Tabbs really run the gamut. Everything from literally threatening to kill people to physically assaulting men, women, and children. So in the Black community, people knew not to mess with Hannah Mary Tabbs. They gave her a lot of room, and that included her old husband.
Wait till you hear this, because she was having an affair with a man 10 years her junior. She has a toy boy, Callie, as well, doesn't she?
She does. And so remember, this is the 1880s. This is the time where of we imagine being sort of, you know, sexual repression and chastity and, you know, these sort of Victorian social ideals. And you have Tab seems to have worked out an understanding with her husband about her sexual needs. And neighbors had, you know, testified that Wakefield Gaines was a daily figure in their home. And Tabs was having an affair with him.
But where this turns dark, in case you'd forgotten, is that Wakefield Gaines is our disembodied torso. He's going to end up in the pond, poor guy. And Kelly, tell me a bit about Hannah Mary Tabbs's supposed niece, this person called Annie Richardson. She's also disappeared, hasn't she?
There's not just one mystery. It's like multiple mysteries. Part of why so many people in the neighborhood are quick to offer testimony against Hannah Mary Tabbs is because they also believe that she had probably killed her niece, who had gone missing for about a year.
How come that she doesn't have a police record?
Policing at this time is incredibly racist. And African-Americans were hugely fearful of having any contact with police for good reason. So Tabbs knew that if she did anything in the white world, she would immediately face harsh consequences. But because of Black people's inability to really rely on police for fair, unbiased protection, she was able to prey on the community.
Is it fair to say, Callie, that the police were only really investigating this in the first place because they believed that the torso in the pond was that of a white person?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a huge part of why the case was solved at all. So even though both of Wakefield Gaines' parents were African-Americans, he nonetheless had a really light complexion, so much so that the authorities were concerned that he actually was a white man. And because of that, the solving the case took on sort of the highest priority among the investigators.
So Tabbs has been arrested. She spends a night in the cells and then she makes a confession. She says that on the morning of the 16th of February, between 9 and 10 o'clock, she was in the kitchen of her house on Richard Street. Wakefield Gaines came to see her, and about 4 minutes later, an acquaintance, this is George Wilson, came in. Gaines was on the sofa reading a paper. Hannah Mary Tabbs herself was eating her breakfast. An argument broke out about the whereabouts of Hannah Mary Tabbs' missing niece, Annie. According to Tabbs, this George Wilson said that he knew where Annie was. And Wakefield Gaines said, oh, is that because you're going with her now? This is what she told the police.
Gaines jumped up and struck George Wilson. They clinched and fought all over the kitchen and fell up against the sewing machine. George Wilson grabbed up a green chair standing there, struck Gaines on the head and knocked him up against the stair steps. And from there, he slid down to the floor. He struck him several times more with the chair while he lay there. He never got up again, never spoke. I said, George Wilson, this is awful. He said, well, he shan't get the best of me. He struck me first. Then George Wilson grabbed hold of the body, moved the coal scuttle off the cellar steps, and pushed and pulled the body down to the cellar. He went out and came back in 20 minutes. He had with him a butcher's cleaver.
So Callie, Hannah Mary Tabbs is placing the blame for the killing firmly upon this new guy who's come into the story. Who is George Wilson?
So George Wilson is a young man in his late teens who lived in the neighborhood. And he also knew Hannah Mary Tabbs' niece, Annie Richardson. He was a young man with a little bit of a checkered past. He had been in a juvenile facility as a youth. His mother was African-American. His father was white. He was very, very light complexioned. And this is something that becomes an issue as the case goes on.
George Wilson is arrested too, and he makes a partial confession. He admits to dumping some parts of the body in a river, but he denies the killing, and he denies using that butcher's cleaver to chop up the body. Callie, both Hannah Mary Tabbs and George Wilson make these confessions after a night in detention with white male detectives in charge of them. They have no support, whether legal or personal. What might have gone on, do you think, in those Philadelphia police cells?
I definitely think that both suspects were terrorized in police custody. Tab's coat was ripped. There was some indication that the black eye that she had seemed more contused, as if perhaps she had been hit again. She definitely appeared to have been roughed up in some ways during custody. Similarly, George Wilson also had been brutalized in custody, so much so that he actually suffered a seizure.
How does it feel to you to be revisiting this piece of history in the light of the protests that there have been in the last couple of years?
There is this sort of harrowing kind of deja vu, because you see that there's a through line between the same kinds of issues and clashes that are emerging today that took place over a century ago. One of the cases that drew huge significance happened about 5 or 6 years ago. It was a case of Sandra Bland. She was a 28-year-old African-American woman who was pulled over by a white police officer in Texas, supposedly for not using a turn signal. I believe in UK, you would call this an indicator. In any event, from this police stop, the situation becomes a violent arrest, and she ends up being found dead, hanging in the jail cell several days later. And so her case is among a number that drew social protests and also called attention to these ongoing kinds of racial disparities in the justice system. The African-American community is still so far from equitable, unbiased policing.
After their confessions, the legal process gets underway. At the inquest into Wakefield Gaines's death, Hannah Mary Tabbs's neighbours on Richard Street, many of them women, they queue up to testify that Tabbs was frightening to them, that she routinely told lies, and that she wasn't only having an affair with the dead man, but also she often argued violently with him too. One neighbour says they argued every day, including Sunday. But the most damning evidence comes from the dead man's sister, Jane, the woman who'd pointed the finger at Hannah Mary Tabbs in the first place.
She had sent my brother a letter saying she would catch up with him if it took her 10 years. She fought with him the last night of December because he was seeing another woman. She slashed his face with a razor, and he ran into my house with blood gushing from his cheek. She called after him that she would kill him yet. She followed him wherever he moved, and he told me he was afraid of her.
Hannah Mary Tabbs and George Wilson are indicted for murder. Wilson is tried first before a jury of 12 white working-class men. Callie, there was a media frenzy around this court case, wasn't there? And it wasn't just so much the gruesomeness of the crime and the disembodied torso, but it was the racial politics too. What did people say about George Wilson's ethnicity?
George Wilson kind of embodied the sum of all fears in the late 19th century. He was a black man who could absolutely pass for white. And so when they lay eyes on him, it sort of stoked all these fears about the ability to infiltrate white society. And I think when he is in custody with the detectives, they are kind of horrified and also, I think, a little bit outraged that he is black, but he doesn't have the sort of sensibility to really demur to them in the way that they were expecting.
Now, Hannah Mary Tabbs appears as a witness in George Wilson's trial. She testifies for the prosecution. She denies having an affair, with Wakefield Gaines or ever arguing with him, and she puts the blame for the murder firmly onto Wilson. She distances herself completely from the dismemberment.
After Wilson dragged the body down to the cellar and it lay stretched on the floor, we stood looking at it for a few minutes. Then Wilson went up the stairs and out the door and was gone about 15 minutes. When he got back, I bolted the front door and fastened the back door and went upstairs. I was there about half an hour when Wilson called to me. He said, "I've got that all fixed now." He was in the kitchen. I went a few steps down the cellar and saw the trunk part of Wakefield Gaines settling against the stair steps and his head lying across the cellar floor wrapped in bits of newspaper. Wilson pointed to the body of Gaines and said, "If you will take that part, I'll take all the rest."
Wilson plea bargains for second-degree murder. He's sentenced to 12 years solitary confinement in Philadelphia's prison, the Eastern State Penitentiary. Having put on such a great show at Wilson's trial, when hers follows, Tabbs pleads guilty to the much less serious crime of accessory to murder. And she's given just 2 years, the maximum penalty allowed for that crime, and it's backdated to when she went into custody. Kelly, this seems to me quite extraordinary that Tabbs, who's got this history of violence, who's previously threatened to kill Gaines, gets away with 2 years in jail, whereas George Wilson, who's much younger than her, possibly has learning difficulties of some kind, he gets convicted of a murder where he has no motive and there are no witnesses apart from Tabbs. What's going on here?
It was a stunning outcome. She denied everything in spite of all of the evidence, but she performed it really well. Like, she was tearful when she was in court. She always had her eyes cast down. She publicly apologized to her husband for not sort of heeding his advice. She was very apologetic, extremely fragile appearing, vulnerable. And she did everything to sort of embody Victorian respectability. And also, I think, to portray herself in a way that demonstrated that she wasn't a threat to white authority. She was brilliant and really astute at understanding the race and gender politics of the period. She was the kind of Black woman that they wanted to see.
Now, I want to know what it would have been like for George Wilson and Hannah Mary Tabbs serving their sentences in the Eastern State Penitentiary. Our Philadelphia historian Annie Anderson went there to find out.
When the penitentiary opened in 1829, it was one of the largest and most expensive building projects the United States had ever seen. Saved from demolition in the 1980s, Eastern State Penitentiary is now a historic site, and it's full of crumbling cell blocks, peeling paint, and broken skylights. I'm here with Lauren Zallett, Eastern State's Director of Education. Lauren, Hannah Mary Tabbs was incarcerated here from 1887 to 1889. Can you tell me a little bit about what her time here would have looked like?
Hannah Mary would have lived in cell block 2, which was the designated women's block. Each received their meals in their cells and likely got 30 minutes of outdoor exercise every day. A lot of men here worked in shoemaking, chair caning, and cigar making, while women did more domestic work, sewing, mending, laundry, and cooking.
And were Black women overrepresented in the prison's population compared to their numbers outside the walls?
Yes. Black people were overrepresented at Eastern State, and Black women especially experienced disproportionately high rates of incarceration compared to the number of Black women in the general Philadelphia population and compared to white women.
Kelly, Lauren there was talking about the high numbers of African-American women in prison compared to the general population.
Right. That trend actually has held, unfortunately. So, for example, today, Black women account for about 13% of women in the U.S. population, but they are 44% of women who are in jail. So they are vastly overrepresented.
Kelly, what was the ending of Hannah Mary Tabbs' story? What happened to her?
She left prison almost immediately at the same time her husband, John Tabbs, died. Now, based on Tabbs' history, I initially was really suspicious about the timing of his death, but it was true. He actually did die of natural causes right around the time of her release. So she actually goes back to Maryland and she stays in the Baltimore area where she works as a servant. At some point, she actually marries again. I was blown away. She remade herself again.
And what about George Wilson?
He does survive his term, which at Eastern in and of itself is an accomplishment. African Americans had a high rate of mortality. He emerges. It does appear that he did marry at some point, and he worked off and on in different kinds of unskilled laboring positions.
And I'm intrigued by what actually became of Hannah Mary Tabbs' supposed niece, this Annie Richardson, the one who'd mysteriously disappeared. What was her story?
So Annie Richardson actually resurfaces working as a servant for a family in New Jersey. She talks about having run away from Hannah Mary Tabbs' home about a year before. She gave her really brutal beatings, so much so that she actually started to fear for her life. And she tells the authorities that even though she refers to Tabbs as her aunt, she actually believes that Tabbs is her mother.
And as for the other character in this story, Wakefield Gaines, well, sadly, the rest of Gaines's body was never found. Callie, what do you think actually happened to him that day in Hannah Mary Tabbs's kitchen?
I think that she and Wakefield probably had a really, really bad argument. She had threatened to kill him many times before, had actually slashed his face with a razor. I think maybe she made good on the threat, hit him over the head with something, knocked him out, thought he was dead. And at that point, I think that she probably either coerced or somehow manipulated Wilson into helping her dismember and get rid of the body. I think that it's very likely that Hannah Mary Tabbs got away with murder.
I can see why you've spent so much time and effort researching the life of this woman who is a working class African-American woman in the 1880s, committing murder and then getting away with it, manipulating the justice system to her benefit.
I'd never met a figure like her in Black women's history before. Tabbs is this unique figure who seemed to sort of unapologetically use violence and intimidation to kind of make her own world at a time where it was incredibly restrictive and repressive for women. But for me, that also is an indication that she probably experienced a lot of violence in her life in the past in order to learn how to be able to use violence in a way where she could win.
Well, thank you ever so much to Dr. Callie Gross, to Annie Anderson, and to Lauren Zalat. I think that we've shown that Hannah Mary Tabbs was quite some lady killer. And don't forget, you can hear the whole series again if you head to BBC Sounds, where you can also find two bonus discussion programmes about our unforgettable lady killers. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Jane Greenwood. The music is composed by Asher Nathan, and the sound design is by Chris McLean. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone. The readers are Moya Angela and Jonathan Keeble. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. And you can listen to the whole series, as well as two bonus discussion programmes, if you search for Lady Killers in BBC Sounds.
Hi. Yeah, you. Hello. Hi. Don't go away. I've got a quick couple of questions for you, if you don't mind. So, how much do you think you really know about the menstrual cycle, beyond the period bit? Did you know, par exemple, that the hormone estrogen makes you smell better? or that your hormones change the way your brain works hour by hour, and that you could even biohack them to maybe, I don't know, bag a job or run a PB. Nope, but that's not surprising, you're not alone there. The mysterious workings of the womb have been a dark secret for centuries. The ancient Greeks thought the womb was a mischievous moving creature that wreaked havoc on the body. And the Victorians, well, they thought that if you examined a woman's vagina, she would devour you in a mad fit of sexual rage. As you can see, we are really on the back foot here. All of us. I'm Indy Rexon, and when I found out about the amazing things that happen in our wombs and brains through the cycle, my mind was so blown that we got to work making this podcast, 28-ish days later, for BBC Radio 4. 28 episodes, each charting every day of the very approximate 28-day cycle. It looks at the science of our bodies and the way that we've been treated through history, and discovers how understanding our cycle can change our lives. Fancy striding back into your powerful menstruating self? Me too. And you can listen to 28-ish days later now on BBC Sounds.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.